This is a Suno India production and you're listening to the Suno India Show.
One day in the year 2020, I went down a rabbit hole of psychology research online, as it happens now and then, and I came across ADHD. ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. I found out that ADHD is much more than what I previously knew. It clicked for me in a completely unexpected way. And at the end of that year, I got a formal diagnosis. This got me thinking that people like me in previous generations would have gone their whole lives thinking that their disabilities are entirely their fault, without the tools to find out what caused them. And I'm not alone. There is a recent Women's Health article exploring how a lot of women are realizing that they have ADHD or autism thanks to social media. This could be because the diagnostic criteria for such neurodivergence was based on boys and men. Thus, they continue to exclude women and gender minorities. The internet, however, has given us the resources to be able to understand ourselves better, even when no one else does. So, how has technology changed the lives of people with disabilities? And what are the ways in which technology perpetuates the inequalities of our ableist world? To find the answers to these questions, let me welcome you to our mini-series on disability and technology, where we talk to people across a range of disabilities. Assistive technology can be any item, equipment, or product system, whether bought or modified, that helps people with disabilities. Assistive technologies can be high-tech and low-tech, from canes and lever doorknobs to voice recognition software and speech-generating devices. In this mini-series, I let our guests define what assistive tech means to them. So you'll have people talking about things from STEM toys to larger infrastructural challenges like a lack of elevators. There are two main lenses of looking at disability. The medical model, where disability is seen as an attribute of an individual health condition, and the social model, where disability is a product of environment. The medical model focuses on the diagnosis and the idea that disabled people need to be quote-unquote cured. The social model of disability sees disability as a result of barriers created by society. Removing these barriers creates equality and offers disabled people more independence, choice, and control. This is where technology can play a significant role. Hi, I am Surya Thapa Mukherjee, your host for the first episode of this mini-series on the Suno India Show. I spoke to Apurupa, a neuroqueer sexuality educator. Neuroqueer is a relatively new term used to describe individuals who are neurodivergent and queer and experience the two as related in their daily life. Neurodivergent is a term that describes people whose brain develops or works differently. It looks at conditions such as ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, etc., as more than just disorders with different strengths and weaknesses. Apurupa is autistic. In India, autism was recognized as a disability in 2016 under the Rights of Persons with Disabilities Act 2016. More people globally are being diagnosed with autism, with a 178% increase in the past 20 years. In India, one in every 100 children below the age of 10 has autism. First, I asked Aparupa what disability is according to them.
So, I mean, when if I were to explain what I think disability is, I should also just take a step back and talk about my own journey with disability. It was way easier for me to come out as queer. It was way more easier for me to come out as non-binary than it was to come out as disabled. Because what I realized with disability, and somehow that internalized shame didn't necessarily exist so much with my queerness for me, was that it's not so much about how I view myself. It's about how the world views me. It's about how the world relates to me, or how, where the world places me in its hierarchy. So disability is essentially for me like a political identity more than anything else. It's the reason why I also very openly and proudly claim it and embrace it is because it's important for me to also talk about the various ways in which, and also represent the various ways in which people may be disabled in this world. So in a world where there is this insistence on normativity, there is this reward almost that one can claim if they fall within the structures. I sort of view disability, and disability can manifest in various forms. Of course, it can be psychosocial, it can be physical, it can be emotional, it can be financial. There are various ways in which one may experience their disability. So I sort of view that as anything that doesn't find that kind of affirmation, validation, and support from the majority.
Okay. And how do you experience your disability?
So I am an autistic person. I am on the autism spectrum. I also suspect that I might be an ADHDer. We are not fully sure of that yet, and that's not a diagnosis that I'm prepared to access as of now. I also live with a horde of mental illnesses, a cocktail of mental illnesses, if you will. I joke about it, and I sort of talk about it as living with them as opposed to being afflicted with them, because I have also come to terms with the fact that that is something that will be a reality in my life. So whether it's my depression, my anxiety, body dysmorphic disorder, PMDD, PCOS, bunch of other issues, like I said. So yeah, that's sort of how I experience my disability in a very label sense. But the way I also experience my disability is in a very social sense as well. The way that I relate to people, the way that, I mean, I've always been called as someone who's really loud, or someone who doesn't maybe know how to mince their words, or who is very idealistic in their sense of justice. So in retrospect, now I'm able to sort of place that in my experience of my disability, as well. And, you know, someone recently commented as to how, oh, isn't everyone, you know, some kind of neurodivergent? And of course, they were coming from a good place, which is why this was an acceptable comment. And maybe sure, you know, maybe all of us like experience some form of neurodivergence, or all of us have a experience of neurodivergence in our lives. But if that is the case, then why is the world as ableist and as productivity driven as it is? Like, why is it not more care centric? And why is it that we are constantly having to, and one of the reasons why I sought my diagnosis, Surya, and I mean, maybe, you know, I'd love to hear about your experience as well. One of the reasons why I sought the diagnosis was to also understand what was really going on. Like, why was it that I was not able to match up to my peers, right? Why was it that I needed, let's say, time to just cocoon and be in a room where I sort of could control all the sensory stimulations and I could stim to my heart's content? Like, why did I need those kind of like literal recharge, you know, cells? So I think it came from that space.
Definitely. Like for me, you know, it was the same thing. It's like, I think in some ways you're seen as like outperforming your peers, and you're kind of, you know, put on a sort of But there's still, like, you know, people have these sort of expectations. And then in other areas, you feel like you really, really kind of lag behind your peers. Mm. You're like, you know, if I can do the things that everyone else finds so difficult, why can't I do the stupid things that, like, come so easily for other people? And of course, like, the whole thing of rest, you know, like, why can't I just keep going? Why do I need to, like, stop? And, like, why do I need so much time to, like, recharge and that sort of thing? So, yeah. So, can you tell me, like, how, like, on a daily basis, like, what does navigating your disability, like, what does that look like on a daily basis for you?
Yeah, I think, Surya, you know, what you said is so, so radical, especially about, like, rest and rest being our resistance, right? As neurodivergent folks, as disabled folks. So I think, like, the perfect description of my experience on a daily basis, is explained, through the spoon theory, right? The spoon theory basically proposes that all of us wake up with, let's say, X number of spoons. And spoons being the amount of energy that we have to just tackle the day. And each task that we undertake uses up one spoon. So uses up like a quantum, a part of that energy that we wake up with. Now, as a neurodivergent person, if an average person, average neurotypical person, let's say wakes up with 10 spoons, I already wake up with 5 spoons, right? Like already existing in itself is challenging because the second I wake up, the sights that I see or the smells that I smell, all like really work up my stimulation. Or, you know, just like one person saying something in the morning, that sort of sets me off, right? And, so I already wake up with 5 spoons. And on top of that, like each task, let's say for a neurotypical person, if it's taking 1 spoon, for me, it's taking 2 spoons. So that sort of means that I'm only able to get by about 2.5 tasks before I need to rest, recuperate. And that can sometimes look like, you know, taking a shower, like a really, really hot shower. It can look like that. Sometimes it can look like, you know, sitting with my partner and sort of like sitting in a hug, in a tight hug for a long time, or like having my weighted blanket on me for a while before I can feel like I'm ready to take over the world. It can look like grounding practices that I've managed to develop over the past few years. It can also look like maybe just, you know, staring into space and not necessarily doing anything or thinking anything, just existing for a while before then I'm able to sort of move on with the day. Now, what this also means that I do work a 9-to-5. So it also means that sometimes that 9-to-5 becomes 9-to-8. And I, you know, experience definitely a lot of guilt, especially around, let's say if a colleague has to work with me till, you know, after their work hours, for instance, or if I'm not able to attend a particular meeting because I'm just not able to. Now, what I then have to resort to at times is masking. And I know that masking absolutely is something that one should not have to do. Masking is essentially where neurodivergent folks would emulate the traits of neurotypical folks in order to appear more neurotypical or just like relate with the world in a more neurotypical way and function in this neurotypical world at times as well. And this is not done to manipulate someone. This is not done to lie to someone. This is more done to, we live in a very ableist world. We live with very ableist structures. Time in itself and the way that we measure time and the way that we reward productivity, like I was saying before, all are quite inherently ableist. So, sometimes I also do resort to masking. I will freely admit that, which is like I will just sort of, you know, say that I need to, for instance, show up at this particular meeting because I just have to. Like I can't possibly explain to someone, and I should be able to in an ideal world. I should be able to say, hey, I'm sort of having a moment here. I can we reschedule to some other time, right? Or can we talk about this over email? Can we change the medium of communication? So so since that's not necessarily the world that we live in, I also do resort to masking, and I will also say that as someone who's received their diagnosis very late in life, like masking is almost like second nature to me. And I've done that, you know, my whole life. And I continue to do that now. And sometimes not very intentionally, as well. It's only in retrospect do I realize that, oh, I was in fact masking and I am in fact burnt out now because of that, because of having to, it's literally like putting on a mask and being someone else or something else in that moment. I mean, since I did bring up masking, I'll also just quickly add that at times I also may mask for joy, to be able to access joy. It's not always, to be able to cope with the pace of a neurotypical world. Sometimes it's also to, let's say, be able to show up at a friend's, party. And while I know that it's going to be an overstimulating environment for me, I also want to participate in their joy. And, while I am increasingly now sort of claiming space as a neurodivergent person there, you know, carrying my stim toys, for instance, talking about my special interests very freely and openly. My special interest happens to be sex. And as a sex educator, I get to sort of talk about it on a daily basis, which is fantastic. But at the same time, I may also choose to, you know, stay a little longer because I just want to participate in the joy of that space, of that community. So, that's sort of what my experiences look like.
Before we continue, let me explain what stimming is. Stimming refers to self-stimulating behaviors, usually involving repetitive movements or sounds. For example, it includes finger flicking, rocking back and forth, repeating certain words, etc. These behaviors can help regulate our emotions. Such behaviors are found to some degree in all people and are frequent in people on the autism spectrum.
Okay, so coming to, you know, the little things and like the little, like in terms of tech, right? Like the things that help. I don't know if stim toys, like how much that counts as tech, but like I would count, you know, just in terms of like things that help you. So what are the things, you know, in terms of tech or other tools that you use that help you?
Sure. I think, Surya, like one thing which I also found problematic as I was sort of exploring stimming, right, was that there is a lot of, like, of course, like stim toys that currently exist can be very useful, and if someone finds them meaningful, then they needn't explain it to anyone. Like, each person's stim is personal to them, neurotypical people's stim as well, and whatever toys work for whoever. But I've also sort of found that a lot of toys that exist are also so created from such a white cishet male need and necessity sort of bracket. So, like, let's say a fidget spinner, for instance, right? Or like one of those cubes, I forget what they're called, but they essentially have like buttons. They have like things that you can snap on, things that you can twist and move and those kind of things, sort of to keep your hand and fingers occupied, which is interesting, right? Which is something that can definitely work for many people. But I've also found that, you know, sometimes just like peeling a label off a jar can be so exhilarating and fun. Right. So I think the way that like all these mainstream toys are also packaged is at the end of the day to sell a product and to sell a product to a person who is most likely to purchase it. But like, do we have something similar for, let's say, someone who has like myself, someone who stims more verbally? How can we make those kinds of stims more acceptable around us as well? And how can, like, let's say, technology and just apps in general and toys as well assist those kind of stims and or enable those kinds of stims is something that you also look at the way that some of these fidget spinners and some of these cubes also became famous. Like, the idea was to make them discreet. The idea was to hide the stim so that a person can appear normal. Whereas, like, can there also be toys which actually celebrate stims? Is sort of where my exploration currently is.
Right. So basically, like, when you're when you're being more vocal or like verbal, it's more obviously like more visible, and it's not discreet. So I guess that's the difference.
Yeah, totally. Or even like, let's say someone wants to use their body, or someone has a tic, right? Like, can there be space for those to be celebrated as well? Or those to be normalized, forget celebrated, right? For them to just be a way in which people exist. Or this insistence of like, let's say, now moving away a little bit from swimming, like also this insistence on, let's say, eye contact, or this insistence that one mustn't doodle while in a space, because doodling is equal to distraction. Like, can all those narratives also be questioned? Right. And I mean, I find that like as a neuroqueer person, like my idea of stimming sometimes looks very different. It also looks like, let's say, you know, feeling the texture of my pride flag. So I actually have a pride flag that, is made out of like linen. So like feeling the texture of that can be stimming for me. I purely in like certain sensations. So like applying balm, even when I don't have a headache or even when I don't have any kind of pain, you know, counts as stimming for me. I also have auditory stim, and vocal stim. So basically, I do enjoy like making weird noises, and that is so much fun for me. And I wish that there were toys that sort of responded to all these different needs of stimming as well. So those are some ways in which I that I sort of access the things that are around me. I mean, digitally, I have found that, you know, there are several apps that I sort of subscribe to in order to survive. I also have like a timer app, where I use the Pomodoro technique, which is basically like working in like spurts instead of like working over long periods of time, and sort of squeezing in periods of rest within that work time, quote unquote. Voice memos are fantastic. I often send myself voice notes of reminders that I need to do, of just like giving myself sometimes instructions, because I also forget to, let's say, drink water, although I'm someone who loves drinking water and, you know, really loves being hydrated. It just skips my mind sometimes, or the bottle is right there, but I can't bring myself to physically drink the water. So, you know, things like that are something that I use. That's sort of how technology has helped me. And apart from that, like, I think social media and, having access to like, you know, content from, neuroqueer folks from across the world has also been so wonderful. In fact, like, you know, learning from other people's lived experiences, because often the issue also becomes that in the mainstream narrative, there is a tendency to over pathologize, and there is also a tendency to, let's say, if you are someone who's diagnosed with autism, the tendency is to also push you towards being more neurotypical, like the normative treatment, quote unquote, that exists. Whereas I believe that I don't need a treatment. Me being neurodivergent is a way that I relate with the world. And I sort of need to find ways in which I can stay afloat in this world. So having that sense of community and that space for expression via social media has also been very interesting for me.
And in terms of like finding, you know, like going on this journey of like seeking a diagnosis, did tech or like, I mean, you know, the internet, since you are a late diagnosed, you know, adult diagnosed person, I'm just wondering, because for me, like, if there was no internet, I don't think I would ever know that I'm neurodivergent. I don't know how I would seek the resources or like do the research. So was that the same for you, or like how was your journey?
Oh, 100%. Like I was saying before, like it was basically through social media, looking at the lived experiences of other neurodivergent people, did I even hold space for the fact that my experience could be that of neurodivergence, because what we otherwise are taught through textbook or through, let's say, popular representation in media is like a very caricaturish representation almost, which could be one way in which, let's say, certain autistic people do experience their autism. But that's not how all of us experience our autism. So like to also view the spectrum, like that's where it first came in, right? From there to like even, let's say, research about a disability affirmative therapist, a disability affirmative psychiatrist. All this happened because like I had access to a device that allowed for me to access. And this was like during pandemic, which is the first time when telemedicine was actually legalized in the country, right? Before that, you couldn't necessarily provide psychiatric services through phone in India. So like the fact that like all this sort of happened the way that it did, I had access to the kind of information, I was able to look up, I was able to do my research. It definitely, like, the diagnosis, or even to say that I'm open to a diagnosis, came from access to the internet for me, definitely.
I asked them how they navigate public spaces where they cannot control their surroundings. What do they do about sensory overload? How do they handle unfamiliar or unexpected situations? Does technology help?
I think firstly, I want to sort of talk about the context of my neurodivergence and my experience with disability, right? It's only been about, let's say, a year and a half since I officially received my diagnosis, since I also started embracing the fact that I could be, and I am, in fact, neurodivergent in various ways. I am someone who, of course, has been diagnosed with autism, but I also do believe that I have experiences of ADHD as well. So I find that in public spaces, I am simultaneously overstimulated and understimulated. So I think like one thing that has really helped me just get from point A to point B is to have something in my ear that feels familiar, that is also, you know, an expression of my special interest. So let's say a podcast on sex, or a podcast on celebrity culture, because I'm a big fan of reality TV, big fan of people. People are also my special interest. So it really helps me have that kind of like white noise almost in my ear. I might not even be paying conscious attention to it. While this may sound like something that everyone does, right? Like people listen to podcasts while they're on the go, and this is a very normal thing to do. What needs to be understood is that in my context, it acts as a mobility aid. It allows for me to just be able to occupy public spaces more, because I'm someone who sort of does need that kind of space between being around people and those cocoon periods, like I'd mentioned. So that is one thing that's proven to be really helpful. Also, let's say I am going to a new place, an unfamiliar place. I do tend to get there like a little bit in advance to orient myself there, to ground myself there. And even before I get to that place, I sort of use Google Maps. I sort of use the satellite view to look at what that place physically looks like. I'm someone who needs as much details as possible. So that is something that I do. And sometimes I, you know, if I'm going to, let's say, meet a new person, I may even, like, let's say, look through their social media to understand who they are as a person, like what are some things that I can talk to them about, because I do tend to need scripts at times, especially like with people and places that I'm very, very unfamiliar with. The other thing that I might do, let's say I'm going to a restaurant, I'm going to be in a social situation where eating would be involved, I will sort of like look through the menu in advance, sort of make a list of things that I can have by myself, make a list of things that I can share with other people, have that kind of like thing in my arsenal, so that in case I am in that moment needing it, like, I think I've often been in situations where, let's say, I've showed up to a place and I've felt compelled to behave or to mask very, very heavily, right? Whereas like having this kind of prep in advance and having access to technology, therefore, allows for me to be as authentic as possible in the situation. Of course, I might still resort to masking, but I think like increasingly I'm also able to articulate masking as masking, right? I'm also able to say to people, because I am vocal about my neurodivergence, I'm also able to say to people that, hey, I am actually masking right now, and have a normal conversation about it. So yeah, that's a bit about me in public spaces.
So yes, yeah, so I just to end with, you know, I just want to know, like, how does tech exclude you? Like, how do you, it can be personal tech, it can be tech or infrastructure in public spaces, so in a larger way, or even on the internet, like, you know, where you can see, like, okay, this is definitely not made with me in mind, or, like, you know, these spaces exclude people like me.
So I mean, obviously, like, there isn't enough tech to really meet me where I'm at, but the tech that also currently exists, I do find that you know, let's say the multiple steps that one has to follow in order to raise a complaint, like when I've placed a food order. I mean, of course, now when you do place those orders, especially like with even with medical apps, you are now able to conduct a lot of you know, your queries and conduct a lot of your business through text messages. But like till very recently, it had to be via a call. You had to interact with another person through a call, which I find extremely challenging. And it's only now have I sort of been able to say, oh, I'm not just bad at calls. It's something that is not really very enabling for me. So can things actually happen via text message, and can they be as impactful in that space? Because we still sort of insist on, even if something can be put on email, we do insist on, let's say, meeting someone, even if it's over a Zoom call. Like that is still a prerequisite. Keeping one's video on is still a prerequisite to show that you are engaged in that space. Whereas like it could very well be the case that, you know, I am engaged, but I do need my video to be off in order to be present in this particular social or official space, right? So I do find that, like, in those ways, I'm still, like, there need to be more accommodations and expansiveness within tech for it to be truly enabling for me. But I also am very cognizant that, like, given my, you know, privileges of language, given my class privilege, given my caste privilege, I also know that it is a lot more accessible for me. I also see a lot more representation of me than, you know, let's say someone from a different identity location would.
Yeah, this has been, like, so relatable, and it's so funny, like, how, you know, you go through life feeling like you don't really relate to people, and then you talk to other neurodivergent people and you're like, huh, like, this is, like, you know, are normal, and like it all makes sense, and it's all like the same. Yeah, so thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me here, Surya. I think it was an extremely validating experience for me. This is one of the first times I've actually articulated my experience of my disability, especially as someone who uses the tech space, digital space quite a bit in their expressions. I also did want to say that, you know, for people who might come from a similar context like me, I think there also comes, you know, a lot of shame when it comes to maximizing our comfort, right? And maximizing just like ease in life. But you don't have to hustle. Like, you don't have to earn comfort. You don't have to earn just being able to access the world the way that, let's say, a neurotypical person is able to, and whatever you need to support and bolster that, you're well within your rights, and you are allowed to access that. So yeah, so I just sort of wanted to say that before we ended our session.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Please rate our podcast and leave a comment if you like it. Underreported and underrepresented stories can become mainstream only if it reaches more people. So please support us by visiting a contributing page on our website, sunoindia.in, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.